in the news, if you turn on the TV, listen to the radio, on any given day, there will probably be something about the Middle East that is included in that. And in the midst of that, it's going to be something in regard to Israel. The Middle East circumstances revolve around the nation of Israel. And there is a reason for that. And I think it is important for us to understand what the rules are, how it impacts the world, and how it impacts, ultimately, us. Israel has existed as a state in the Middle East now for 58 years. They declared independence in 1948. That is a very short time. In that short time, they have existed in the midst of a continuous state of war. There has never been a time since the Declaration of Independence where Israel has not been threatened and under attack or assault in some way. The ability for Israel to return to statehood, they had their nation and the capital of Jerusalem dating back to the time of David. They lived in that land as part of Israel, the Jews of Israel, from the time of the Exodus out of Egypt. They have a running history in that land. But they were expelled from the land by the Romans because of the constant rebellions after the time of Jesus Christ, and were sent out into the diaspora and scattered out among various countries throughout various lands. After World War I, the Ottoman Empire was dissolved and British protectorate, British rule, took over that area of the world. The fact that the Ottoman Empire had been in existence for over 600 years dictated that there weren't normal, natural boundaries of the nations of what we see there today. It was part of their empire. And in the course of the end, again, of World War I, many of those national boundaries were created. The Arab countries that exist in the Middle East, by country and nation, and by the lines that have been drawn, in many cases, have only existed, frankly, from the time of World War I on as well. At that time, there was British support for a Palestinian homeland for the Jews. The Balfour Declaration was presented and publicized. And again, the Zionist movement gained a little ground and a little steam as the Jews began to look for a place where they could again return to their home, a way where they could return to their home. After World War II and the Holocaust, there was more world sympathy on their behalf. And in 1947, the United Nations voted to partition what was called Transjordan into Palestine and Israel. Hostilities broke out immediately. There were attacks against villages of the Jews. There were bombings. There were low-key warfare and where the villagers were trying to defend and maintain themselves. And finally, in 1948, Israel just declared themselves to be a nation and prepared to defend themselves against what would immediately happen. Indeed, what happened the very next day. The armies of Egypt and Syria, Transjordan, as it was called, Iraq and Lebanon attacked together. They made a call for the Arabs in Israel to leave the land immediately, and the reason was, and the bottom line rule, which exists to this day, it is important to understand because the news media does not address it in this respect. The Arabs were encouraged to leave Israel so that the Jews could be completely exterminated and destroyed. They wanted the Arabs out of the way so that they could simply level the place and kill the inhabitants that remained. That's where the refugee camps came from. That's where the Palestinians, who have been maintained in refugee camps, came from. They left Israel in order to make way for the armies of the Arabs so that the Jews could be destroyed. Those Palestinians, as they have come to be called, they were not called that at that time, but those Palestinians, as they have come to be called, were not assimilated into any of the Arab states. They were kept separate, they were maintained separate and in camps in order to promote and fester a war against Israel. Israel, the Jews, are physical descendants of God's people. Spiritual Israel is obviously spiritual Jews of the church. The Jews do not have God's true knowledge and religion. The religion of the Jews is not the religion of the Old Testament. But they do play out very significantly in God's prophetic plan. And again, the circumstance in the Middle East is something for us to be aware of, to watch, and to learn what we can to be aware of what is taking place. Those Arabs who stayed in Israel became Israeli citizens. They became part of that nation state. They were accepted in Israel and allowed to worship freely. But from that point on, war and terrorism became the norm. There was the Suez War in 1956. There was the Six-Day War in 1967. There was the Yom Kippur War in 1973. And each time, as Israel defended itself and defeated the enemies who attacked it, each time as they conquered territory, they would in the end end up releasing that territory or parts of it and return it to the people who had attacked them in the first place. The rule of those Arab states was that Israel must be destroyed. That is where the PLO came from, and it's in their charter. That is what Hamas has openly and repeatedly established and declared, and that is what Hezbollah has also openly and repeatedly supported and promoted as well. There's a psalm that speaks of Israel's enemies historically, but also prophetically, and that is Psalm 83. I wanted to address this because I wanted to address the way Islam, on the one hand, is presented to us in the media, but the way it in reality functions. And ultimately, those who are zealots in Islam, those who are zealots for what the Prophet Muhammad, as they call him, for what was recorded that he said, and how it plays out to this day. Psalm 83. Again, written historically, because those who conspired against Israel in that day, our Bible reading program gives additional notes on this passage and again points out some of the indications that it is also prophetic against what would happen in the end time. Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. Do not be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation. That is the bottom line. Let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. They have consulted together with one consent. It is indeed a union of Muslim nations in opposition to the existence of Israel in their midst. They form a confederacy against you. And then it goes through and begins to describe the group and the individual groups of the nations that existed in that day and as we would see them down into our time. The tents of Edom. Edom includes some of the Palestinians, some of the Turks that came out of, again, the Ottoman Empire that were Arab in that respect. And the Ishmaelites, the Arabs in general, trace their historical and cultural and biological lineage to Ishmael. Ishmael's mother was an Egyptian. Egypt always has played central to the Arab people, the Arab family. But the Ishmaelites, it says Moab, which is basically Jordan, central Jordan, the Hagarites, Northern Arabs or Syria in that respect. It's the same players. These people are in the same places basically over this period of time. Gebal and Ammon are in Jordan. Amalek are the Edomite Palestinians again. Philistia were the inhabitants of Tyre. It's amazing if you begin to look around and look at who the Philistines are. There are a Philistine people in the Middle East today. They are on the Gaza Strip. There's a reason why the Gaza Strip is where it is and why the people in that area have united in the way that they have. They are a historical people, the Philistines. With the inhabitants of Tyre, and again, that would be southern Lebanon on the coast. Assyria has also joined with them. Now, if we look at Assyria, ethnically, we look to Germany and the history of the German people. But if we look at Assyria in terms of where it lay in the time of this psalm, then indeed we're looking geographically at northern Iraq. It would be hard to say exactly if the Assyria here is a reference to that historical area, or again the fact that there's allies with Germany, because that at this point does not appear in the same respect. I think that at least an indication would be that these are references to nations about Israel in that day. It says, they have helped the children of Lot, again, Moab, Ammon, or Jordan. So it portrays a group of nations that form a confederacy against Israel so that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. Let us cut them off from being a nation. Now that is exactly what the rules are today. Israel defends itself for its very survival. One of the leaders who has spoken out recently on record had mentioned that it's very convenient for them to have all gathered in one place so that they can all be destroyed together. The anti-Semitism that is tolerated and even promoted in much of our culture is dramatic. It is incredible indeed. Genesis 16 is a prophecy as well. Genesis 16 and verse number 1. It's a prophecy of Ishmael. I'll be there eventually. There it is. I think Genesis would be easy to find. I mean, it's got a very specific spot in our Bible. But the story of Ishmael was Hagar's mother. It says Sarai, that became Sarah, easier for me. Abraham's wife had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian handmaid, a maidservant. His name was Hagar. And Sarah said to Abraham, see now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go to my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her. Abraham heeded the voice of Sarah. And Sarah, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, a maid, the Egyptian, and he gave her to her husband Abraham to be his wife, after Abraham had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. Hagar despised Sarah and began to treat her despitefully so. Then Sarah said, Abraham, my wrong be upon you. I gave my maid to your embrace. When she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me. Abraham said to Sarah, indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do to her as you please. And when Sarah dealt harshly with her, she fled from her presence. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from? Where are you going? She said, I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarah. So the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hand. Now that's important. Because when you see in the Arab community, when they have ever had to submit, the only times of peace there have been with Israel was when the Arabs had to submit under their hand. And the minute that there was leverage in which that was not required, there was open war. And that sounds like a very strong political statement, but I'm saying it is biblical, it is historical, and it is true. And the angel of the Lord said to her, I will multiply your descendants exceedingly. The Arab nations are a huge body of people covering North Africa and through the Middle East in a large, large body of people, so that they shall not be counted for a multitude. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He shall be a wild man. He is the progenitor of the Arab people. He shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. a wild man, almost like a beast. Now that's God's record prophetically of Ishmael. And it is in part very much the record historically of some of the descendants of his people. Those, the Muslims who are passionate, who are militant, are the ones who are taking Islam and following its precepts to the extreme. When a crusader who was calling himself a Christian went on the crusade, he was violating Christianity. Violating Christianity. When a Muslim kills a Jew, he is actually fulfilling the instructions that they were given in the Quran. It is important to understand that that is true. There are secular Christians who do as they please. They have a culture of Christianity, but they are not particularly observant of the law. There are secular Muslims who do as they please. They have a culture of their religion, but they don't necessarily follow it according to its specific instructions. But there are those who become zealous and militant, and indeed, they fulfill the purpose for which they have been taught. It is a very tragic circumstance, but it is why there has not been peace in the Middle East. Speaking about Islam is a little bit maybe like trying to speak about Christianity, with the exception that I grew up in Christianity. I was born, in that sense, a Catholic, baptized as an infant. I was raised a Protestant in the Presbyterian Church. I know the culture in a broad respect of the Presbyterian Church. Obviously, I've never been a Muslim. And so to take a religion as broad as that is, with its different parts and elements, and to try to boil it down, I do have to rely in part on other individuals who have made their studies in that area. There are denominations in Christianity that are in some ways different and yet in other ways the same. But there are fundamental Christian issues that can be addressed. And the same is true for Islam. I would like to read you an article written by Professor Moshe Sharon, and he teaches Islamic history at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. At least he did in 2003. He's a professor there teaching Islamic history. Speaks Arabic, speaks Hebrew. And I would like to read you some of his comments regarding the agenda of Islam, and he titles it A War Between Civilizations. My point is this. The war that has begun in the Middle East will not cease until the return of Jesus Christ. When you talk about a war to end all wars, this is it. There are reasons for that, and they're partly explained in this way. He says, the driving principles of Islam. Let me explain the principles that are driving the religion of Islam. Of course, every Muslim has to acknowledge the fact that there is only one God. But it's not enough to say that there is only one God. A Muslim has to acknowledge the fact that there is one God and Muhammad is his prophet. These are the fundamentals of the religion that without them one cannot be a Muslim. In reference to the Bible, he distills the Bible down this way. He says there is one thing that is important in the Bible. It leads to salvation. In Judaism, it leads to national salvation. Judaism as a physical Messiah, where people are better in prosperity and there's opportunity, where the lion and the lamb lay down together eventually in the end. He says the New Testament took the Hebrew Bible, in other words, Christianity, took the Old Testament and added to it anew, and moves us toward a personal salvation. You see, it is a national salvation with the Jews as such. It is a personal salvation with the Christian. But the key word is salvation. Personal salvation means that each individual is looked after by God himself, who leads a person through his word to salvation. This is the idea of the Bible, whether we're talking about the Old or the New Testament. All the laws of the Bible, even the smallest ones, are in fact directed towards this fact. Let's look at the essence, though, of Islam. Islam was born with the idea that it should rule the world. I can quote here in Arabic He says, there's no point in quoting that. Let me simply quote a verse to you in English. Allah sent Muhammad with the true religion so that it should rule over all the religions. Muhammad did accept the existence of all the biblical prophets before him. However, he said that these were all prophets, they were Muslims. Abraham was a Muslim. In fact, Adam himself was the first Muslim. Isaac and Jacob, David and Solomon, Moses and Jesus were all Muslims. All of them had writings similar to the Quran. Therefore, world history is Islamic history because all the heroes of history were Muslims. Now, in spite of the fact that none of this existed before Muhammad, but that is what is openly taught. Why, then, is the Bible not similar to the Quran? Muhammad explains that the Jews and Christians forged their books. They had not, had they not been changed and forged, they would have been identical to the Quran. Christians and Jews do have some truth. They can live under Islamic rule provided they keep to the rules that Islam promulgates for them. You live under Islamic rule as long as you do what the Muslims will say the rules are for you to exist in their midst. What happens if a Muslim in Saudi Arabia converts to Christianity? He's killed. It is illegal to convert, to leave the faith. It is illegal in the same sense to ever turn over a piece of land that has been conquered by Islam and return it to any other people or any other faith. It is illegal in their eyes. What happens if Jews and Christians don't want to live under the rules of Islam? Then Islam has to fight them, and that fighting is called jihad. Jihad means war against those people who don't want to accept the Islamic rule. Now, there are elements of Islam that will temper some of those words and make jihad just a personal quest. But the main Islamic religion that is being sent out into the world comes out of Saudi Arabia. It is one of the strictest sects of Islam, and it technically means just what it says. It means war against those who refuse to accept Islamic rule. He says, a few days ago, I received a pamphlet that was distributed in the world by bin Laden. He calls for jihad against America as the leader of the Christian world. Not because America is the supporter of Israel, but because Americans are desecrating Arabia with their filthy feet. There are Americans in Arabia where no Christians should be. In this pamphlet, there is not a single word about Israel, only that Americans are desecrating the home of the prophet. This is where it becomes very significant. The Quran sees the world as divided into two. One part has come under Islamic rule, and one part which is supposed to come under Islamic rule in the future. There is a division in the world which is very clear. Every single person who studies Islam knows it. The world is divided as Dar al-Islam, the house of Islam, and that's the place where Islam rules. And the other part is called Dar al-Harb, or the house of war. It is not called the house of non-Muslims. You don't have the house of Islam and then the house of the non-Muslim people. You have the house of Islam and you have the house of war. It is this house of war which is to be at the end time conquered. The world will continue to be in the house of war until it comes under Islamic rule. That is the norm. That is why there has never been peace in the Middle East, why there cannot be, or there will not be, why the peace treaties that are signed are fraudulent and simply an attempt to buy time until the war can continue, the jihad can be finished. Any territory that comes under Islamic rule cannot be de-Islamicized. Even if at one time or another the non-Muslim enemy takes over the territory that was under Islamic rule, it is considered to be perpetually Islamic. That is why whenever you hear about the Arab-Israeli conflict, you hear about territory, territory, territory. There are other aspects to the conflict, territory that was highly important. The Christian civilization has not only been seen as a religious opponent, but as a dam stopping Islam from achieving its final goal for which it was created. Islam was created to be the army of God, the army of Allah. Every single Muslim is a soldier in the army. Every single Muslim that dies fighting for the spread of Islam is a what? Every single Muslim that dies fighting, no matter what they did or how they did it or how terrorist or how brutal the circumstances were, they are called a martyr. And it is the guarantee for paradise. Doesn't matter if you blew up children or women or soldiers or civilians, you are a martyr, you are a soldier of Islam. No matter how he dies, because it is very important, this is an eternal war between two civilizations. It's not a war that stops. The war is there because it was created by Allah. Islam must be the ruler. It is a war that will not end. This is not stated openly and directly. Peace in Islam can exist only within the Islamic world. Peace can only be between Muslim and Muslim. With a non-Muslim world or non-Muslim opponents, there can only be one solution. A ceasefire until Muslims can gain more power. It is an eternal war until the end of days. Peace can only come if the Islamic side wins. The two civilizations can only have periods of ceasefires. How many ceasefires have there been in Israel? How long did they last? And what happened as a result? Did Israel attack first, or did Israel have to defend against the next assault on their borders? This idea of ceasefire is based on a very important historical precedent, which incidentally Yasser Arafat referred to when he spoke in Johannesburg after he signed the Oslo Agreement with Israel. A few weeks after the Oslo Agreement was signed, Arafat went to Johannesburg, and in a mosque he made a speech in which he apologized, saying, "Do you think I signed something with the Jews that is contrary to the rules of Islam?" Arafat continued, "That is not so. I'm doing exactly what the Prophet Muhammad did." And the author of the article says, "I have a copy of the recorded speech. I have heard these words from his own mouth." He says, whatever the Prophet is supposed to have done becomes a precedent. What Arafat was saying is, remember the story of Hudaybiyah. Hudaybiyah was a circumstance where Muhammad went to Mecca. And there was a contest there, and his opponents were stronger than he was. And so he signed a treaty with them for 10 years. 10 years. A treaty of peace. He returned and trained 10,000 soldiers, and in 2 years returned, marched on the city of Mecca, and conquered it. The precedent was, you can make peace for up to 10 years. After 10 years, you are required to return to jihad. And if in the course of the 10 years you are able to strengthen yourself to where you are able to best your opponent, then you will return and break your agreement and conquer them in the meantime. Because that is what Muhammad did. Thus, in Islamic jurisdiction, it became a legal precedent which states that you're only allowed to make peace for a maximum of 10 years. Secondly, at the first instance you are able, you must renew the jihad and break your agreement. Is that not the historical record of the Middle East over the last 60 years? Until you understand that that is how the rules are written, then it is hard sometimes to understand what is taking place. What makes Islam accept ceasefire? Only one thing. When the enemy is too strong, it is a tactical choice. It is highly important to understand how a civilization sees the end of days. In Christianity and in Judaism, we know exactly what is the vision of the end days. In Judaism, it's going to be like in Isaiah. Peace between nations, not just one nation, but between all nations. People will not have any more need for weapons. Nature will be changed. A beautiful end of days, the kingdom of God on earth. Christianity goes as far as Revelation to see a day when Satan, as the author writes here, himself is obliterated. There are no more powers of evil. That's the vision. I'm speaking now as a historian to try to understand how Islam sees the end of days. In the end of days, Islam sees a world that is totally Muslim, completely Muslim, under the rule of Islam, complete and final victory. Now, I don't deny that when Jesus Christ returns to the earth, he's going to set up the truth and the religion that he gave to mankind over the earth, that he's going to require it. But you must understand that Jesus Christ is real, that he's giving the truth. And Muhammad was listening to demons and made up a religion that then took over a good portion of, indeed, the earth. Christians will not exist. Because according to many Islamic traditions, the Muslims who are in hell will have to be replaced by somebody, so they'll be replaced by Christians. The Jews will no longer exist, and again, this is the basic rule. We will see that their name no longer exists. We will see they no longer are a nation. The only solution to the Middle East from those who are militant Muslims who actually do what Muhammad taught them to do, and by at least the records that were then kept. The only solution is to destroy every single Jew. That is the solution. The ultimate solution, right? The Holocaust was part of that process in a different way. The Jews will no longer exist because before the coming of the end of days, there's going to be a war against the Jews where all Jews should be killed. I'm quoting now from the heart of Islamic tradition, from the books that are read by every child in school, from what the children are taught from the infancy up, and to learn to be a martyr and to go and prepare themselves for jihad against the Jews. The Jews will all be killed. They'll be running away and hiding between trees and rocks, and on that day Allah will give mouth to the rocks and trees, and they will say, O Muslim, come here. There is a Jew behind me. Kill him. Without this, the end of days cannot come. This is fundamental to Islam. When the president of Iran states that it is necessary to foment world strife in order to bring on the last ruler of that religion and to bring on the end of days, they understand in their own minds that their goal is to destroy Israel and to bring up as much turbulence in the process in order for these things to take place. Is there a possibility to end this dance of war? The answer is no. Not in the foreseeable future. What we can do is reach a situation where for a few years we may have relative quiet. But for Islam, the establishment of the State of Israel was a reverse of Islamic history. First, Islamic territory was taken away from Islam by Jews. You know by now that this can never be accepted, not even 1 meter. So everyone who thinks Tel Aviv is safe is making a grave mistake. Territory, which at one time was dominated by Islamic rule, has now become non-Muslim. Non-Muslims are independent of Islamic rule. Jews have created their own independent state. It is anathema. And this is the worst. Israel, a non-Muslim state, is ruling over Muslims. It is unthinkable that non-Muslims should ever rule in that way. The violence that began to be more openly expressed when Israel became a nation is not going to end. It is a perpetual conflict, and it will not end until the return of Jesus Christ. Now, another list I have here of certain events that have taken place so that we can look at our history that we've lived through and are watching play out. There is one event that started this chain of process in a specific way against the United States. There is one event where Israel, the United States as a descendant of Israel, failed to stand up and defend themselves. It was perceived as enormous weakness. And we have been paying double and triple and more ever since. Says it was a cool day in November of 1979 in a country going through religious and political upheaval when a group of Iranian students attacked and seized the American embassy in Tehran. The attack on a sovereign U.S. embassy sets the stage for events to follow for the next 25 years. This was written a couple of years ago, so it would be a couple of years more than that in total. The taking of the American embassy in Iran set the stage for the attacks that then proceeded against the United States because the United States was afraid to stand up and defend themselves in that way. I understand that we do not have a noble nation. I understand that our nation is not obedient to God, that they have abortion, that they have corruption, that they have pornography, and they promote it and legalize it, and it is terrible, a terrible thing to understand. But by the same token, this nation lives in the midst of other nations, and when they chose not to defend themselves, it was prophetic, and it has led forth to some very serious circumstances that follow. It's a little bit like taking blood and just scattering it in the water where there are sharks and the feeding frenzy that then would result. So it goes through and it begins to show the incidents that then followed the taking of the embassy. And it's a little bit eye-opening to realize and understand. Shortly after the Tehran experience, Americans began to be kidnapped and killed throughout the Middle East. The list is way too far, way too long to go through specifically. In April of 1983, a large vehicle packed with high explosives was driven into the U.S. Embassy compound in Beirut, killed 63 people. 6 months later, in 83, a large truck heavily laden down with over 2,500 pounds of TNT smashed through the main gate of the Marine Corps headquarters in Beirut. 241 U.S. servicemen were killed. 2 months later, in December of 1983, another truck loaded with explosives was driven into the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait. The following year, in September of 84, a van was driven in the gate of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, and America fled. In April of 1985, a bomb exploded in a restaurant frequented by U.S. soldiers in Madrid. In August of 85, a Volkswagen loaded with explosives was driven into the main gate of the U.S. Air Force base at Green, Maine. 22 were killed. 59 days later, in 1985, a cruise ship, the Achille Lauro, and you will remember the Achille Lauro because they took a crippled passenger who was a U.S. citizen and singled him out for execution to send a message to the world. TWA Flight 840, April 1986, killed four when they bombed it. Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988, killed 259 when they bombed that. January of 1993, two CIA agents were shot and killed as they entered CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. The following month, in February of 1993, a group of terrorists are arrested after a rented van packed with explosives is driven into the underground parking garage of the World Trade Center in New York City. 6 people killed, 1,000 injured. The onslaught of attacks against our nation by the extreme elements of the Muslim community began with the taking and sacking of our embassy in Iran. And because we did not respond or defend ourselves or hold accountable those who participated in it, it was like food for the sharks. It was like blood in the water. In November of 1995, a car bomb exploded in the U.S. military complex in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, killing 7 servicemen and women. A few months later, June of 96, another truck bomb explodes 35 yards away from the U.S. military compound in Dehran, Saudi Arabia. It destroyed the Khobar Towers, a U.S. Air Force barracks, killing 19, injuring over 500. Simultaneous attacks then followed on 2 U.S. embassies, one in Kenya and one in Tanzania. They killed 224. And the article goes through in the U.S. slept. Hit the snooze alarm and turned back over. The USS Cole was docked in Aden, Yemen, for refueling on the 12th of October 2000 when a small craft pulled alongside the ship and exploded, killing 17 U.S. Navy sailors. And what happened? What was the response? They picked the ship up and hauled it home and patched it and put it back in the water. Of course, you know the events of September 11th, 2001. Most Americans think that was the first attack against U.S. soil or in America. How wrong they are. America has been under constant attack since 1979, and it is not going to quit. It is as Israel striving to survive in the Middle East. It is never going to quit. The war has been engaged, the battle has started, and it will not be finished until Jesus Christ himself returns in that way. We go to Leviticus 26, and we look at what God said would happen to his people if they turned away from him. He said what would happen to his people if they obeyed him, if they served him, and continued to keep the commandments that they had been given. Leviticus 26, starting in verse number 3. The good news first. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and perform them, then I will give you rain in its season. The land shall yield its produce. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall last for the time of vintage. The vintage shall last for the time of sowing. You shall eat your bread to the full. I'll bless what you do in the field. I'll bless what you do in your homes. I'll bless what you do in the market. You shall eat bread to the full, and you will dwell in your land safely. I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none will make you afraid. Do we have that today? We have it to a degree. I can lay down in my house and not be afraid in my house. But this nation is under attack and assault, and many have died in the process, and it has just begun. I will rid the land of evil beasts, and the sword will not go through your land. The sword is beginning to go through our land. It has been going through the land of Israel in a dramatic fashion. It is beginning to come through our land as well. You will chase your enemies, and they shall fall by the sword before you. 5 of you shall chase 100. 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight. Terrorists can spend $1 million in opposition to us, and we spend $100 million to defend. It is just the opposite. They throw a pittance, and we have to go effectively and break the bank. It is why the money supply is being inflated, because of the money in Afghanistan, the money in Iraq, the money. We gave Israel weapons to attack Lebanon, and now we're giving Lebanon money to rebuild from what was destroyed by the weapons. How long can you do that? How long can you play both sides and try to befriend those, in some respects, quite frankly, who cannot be befriended? Your enemies will fall by the sword before you. For I will look on you favorably and make you fruitful, multiply you and confirm my covenant with you. You shall eat the old harvest, clear out the old because of the new. I will set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. I will walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. That's the new covenant, effectively. I will be your God, and you'll be my people. That's the entry in terms of the calling into relationship. But even physically, Israel is called into relationship to God, and he said, I will bless you if you will submit yourself to me. And the descendants of Israel have the benefit in that very same way. Verse 14, the bad news. If you do not obey me, and do not observe all these commandments, and if you despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgment, so that you do not perform all my commandments, but break my covenant, I will do this to you. I will even appoint terror over you. Now the terror here appears to be in the context of disease, but think about that. He says, I will appoint terror over you. They're called terrorists, and they are attacking us. They are attacking us in dramatic and continuous ways. Wasting disease and fever, which shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart. You will sow your seed in vain, and your enemies shall eat it. I will set my face against you, and you shall be defeated by your enemies. Your enemies, if they be weaker, if they not be as powerful militarily, they will chase, 5 of them will chase 1,000 of you. All there has to be is a small, little, tiny threat, and you can't even carry a stick of chapstick on a plane. You think they're not chasing us, and we're running? Those who hate you shall reign over you, and you shall flee when no one pursues. We just got to where you could take a nail clippers back on the plane. You'll flee when no one pursues, like you're going to take that plane out of the sky with your nail clippers. We have reacted in ways at times that have gone beyond belief. Because of fear. Because of what God said would happen, and it's playing out right here. And after all this, if you do not obey me, then I will punish you 7 times more for your sin. I will break the pride of your power. Because God has taken away his blessing, as he describes here, from our land, we did not defend ourselves or retaliate when an act against our embassy was taken. And when our prestige in that part of the world was destroyed. and we have paid dearly for our sins. We will pay more. I will make your heavens like iron and your earth like bronze. Your strength shall be spent in vain. In vain. Hundreds of millions, billions of dollars going down a rat hole, never to be benefited again. Your land shall not yield its produce, nor your trees the land yield their fruit. It just goes on. It says, if you walk contrary to me and not willing to obey me, I will bring on you 7 times more plagues according to your sins. I will also send wild beasts among you. I think the reference here is to literal wild beasts, okay? But what is the beast's power? It is a political entity portrayed in the Bible that will act as a beast. What indeed is a terrorist who would try to kill women and children, whether civilians, whether military, and just destroy them in any way, to make them suffer as much as they can? That is a beast. In type, I would have to say, certainly it would apply in terms of how this is being fulfilled. I will send wild beasts among you, which will rob you of your children, destroy your livestock, and make you few in number. Your highways shall be desolate. The airlines are going absolutely broke. They can't afford to pay for the security and the disruption and the cost and the empty planes at times when people are afraid to travel. Your highways shall be desolate. Israel is in the midst of this. We are on our way. And if by these things you are not reformed in me, but walk contrary to me, then also I will walk contrary to you. I'll punish you, yes, 7 times for your sins. I will bring a sword against you that will execute the vengeance of my covenant. When you're gathered together within your cities, I'll send pestilence among you, and you shall be delivered into the hand of your enemy. This is a sad story to read, but it is something I think we need to understand. We need to understand where the threat is coming from in this way and why it will not end. But we need to also understand that it's the sins of our people that have brought these curses on us. And brethren, we live in the midst. We are affected by the culture of this country. The immodesty that sometimes exists among our people is because of the immodesty of this culture. The trash that we sometimes listen to, or the trash that we sometimes watch, comes because of the culture of these people. And we are sucked into it, and we must not be. God has said clearly that there is a curse that comes on the land that turns away from his covenant, from his obedience, from his law. This may seem like a rather strange topic for an activity weekend, right? Tonight we have a picnic at the Ines. Tomorrow we play at Silverwood and have a great and grand time. 2 weeks ago we had a camp out. We floated down the North Fork of the Coeur d'Alene. You know, life's good overall for us. Life is good. We have the residual of the blessings that were promised to the descendants of Abraham, but they are under assault. They're under assault because of sin. So why did God then call us? How many of you in this room right here walked into church or began to understand the truth and began to obey God between 1965 and 1975? I mean, how many? Look at this. Now, some of us are young, so we couldn't have been there. But almost the majority of the older members in this room came into this church at one moment in time because God had a work to do. And he gave us the opportunity to serve him during the heat of the day, to fulfill our labor in this lifetime, to serve before him, to work to encourage and strengthen one another, and to do his work. He did not call us so that we could just have a good time. No, the heat of the day, out in the vineyard, serving him in that respect. That's why we were called. We were called to repentance. Does that mean we can't have a good time? It does not. But it means in doing so, let us always keep in mind the purpose. Let us dress in modesty. Let us speak respectfully. Let us love in our relationships. Let us fill our minds with wholesome, proper, strengthening nourishment, and let us not buy into this culture around us that is set for destruction while we are in its midst. Ecclesiastes 9. Ecclesiastes 9 says, go ahead. Rejoice. Have a good time. Laugh and enjoy your family and your wife, your mate, your children. Do those things which are good and right and positive and true and pure. We're not supposed to be walking around moaning and groaning and hanging our heads. But we need to know what's going on in the midst of which we live. We need to understand why it is that war will not go away. But in that context, he gives us Ecclesiastes 9, verse 7. Go, eat your bread with joy. Drink your wine with a merry heart. God has already accepted your work. Let your garments be white. Let your head lack no oil. Take advantage of the blessings and the fruitfulness that God has given to us. Live joyfully with your wife whom you love all the days of your vain, temporary existence. That's what vain means, what she has given you under the sun. All the days of vanity, this temporary life, it'll go away, it won't be here long. For that's your portion in life, and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. Chapter 11, verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. That it's not just here because we want to have a good time. We are here as God's servants, called, most of us, in the heat of the day to serve out our life, fulfilling His purpose. To lend our labor and our prayer and our tears to His work and to helping and serving each other. It says, remove sorrow from your heart, put away evil from your flesh. Childhood and youth are vanity, they go away. Life goes on. And in the end, God says, remember, rejoice, but I will give you account. I will hold you, bring you to account for all the deeds that you do. Luke 21 is a passage that talks about the end time and the prophecies in the end time. And of course, the context is wars in Jerusalem. And there are going to be, the wars, it will never cease. Until it finishes, it will never cease. What you have seen begin will continue. But verse 34 of Luke 21 says, take heed to yourself. Bless your hearts in the context of the end time and all that happens and all these things taking place. Take heed to yourself. Let your hearts be weighed down with carousing or drunkenness, the cares of this life, and the day come upon you unexpectedly that you're not really focused. I mean, it ought to wake us up when we see one more war, one more assault, one more attack in Jerusalem. And in addition to that, the sins of our people, which sometimes are so enticing and so attractive, and yet so impure. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the earth. Watch, therefore. Watch the event. Watch yourself. Watch your own heart. And pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. There is the house of Islam, and there is the house of war. We live in the house of war as this plays out. The battle is going to continue, but God says, I want you to live in the midst, coming out of those values and doing what I have given you to do, fulfill my purpose to be my will. So we're not to walk around and to mourn and to mope. We're supposed to rejoice before God, but we should keep our eyes open. And we should understand why it is that these things will be solved.